Hi, my name is Ellie Oppenheimer, and I'm just warning you that this week my daddy and his friends might swear. So if you don't like swearing, then get the hell out of here.
Hamotzi lechem min haaretz.
Amen.
All right, Ellie, you get the first bite.
You get the first piece.
Grab it. First piece of challah.
Oh, it looks so good.
Ellie loves her carbs.
We need to carb load because we got, you know, we're recording an episode today.
Ellie's had two donuts this morning, and it's only 8:52.
I like your style.
Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast by so many metrics. Any metric you throw at us, we win. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, back up to three children at home. One came back from camp. And I'm joined as ever by Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
Hello. And Leah Leibowitz.
I'd like to wish you a happy Zion B'Tammuz fast day.
Right. That's right. The rabbi, I was actually at Minyan last night, and the rabbi mentioned that. And then he mentioned that it's a long fast because days are long.
Days are long.
Days are long. Our guests this week are Jenna Joslett, who's written a book about the history of the Ten Commandments and has written so much more, and cat therapist Carol Wilborn, who, to say the least, is the cat's meow.
Boom!
Anyway, what's up, Jews? I've already delivered my news, which is that Ellie's back from summer camp, which is after 2 weeks away. Rebecca's still off. We're back up to 0.75 fullness. I don't know. What do you guys got?
I mean, I have nothing that good.
Is there anything going on in your life that, like, you're excited for and say, like, 2 months?
Well, we're in the 2 month home stretch to my wedding.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm engaged. I don't know if you guys know that.
Yeah, I noticed. What's that on your finger?
A ring. So, yeah, everything suddenly seems, like, very imminent.
Do basic betches say ring?
I don't know. I do, though. Okay. No, I just did that time. I just was trying it out.
It started here. Right.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I like that you assume that, like, I speak the language of basic batches. I bring that to the table. But I just kind of made it up.
I'm probably the biggest.
Yeah, you're the most basic.
The most basic bitch here.
Mark's like a basic dad.
A little bit, yes.
All right, Liel, what do you got going on?
I have gloriously nothing.
Nothing.
It's amazing.
Nothing at all.
You reading anything?
I am reading.
What are you? Because when you have nothing going on, that means you have six books going on.
When I have nothing going on, that means I read Holocaust books.
Why? You're always reading Holocaust books.
I know.
Are you reading some classics? Are you back in, like, David Wyman, Lucy Davidovich? Like, are you going old school?
I'm rocking avant-garde shit. I'm rocking, like...
Give us some racks.
2016, 2017 vintage Auschwitz architecture, man. Like,
oh, man.
The shit.
Do you want to know how it ends?
Don't spoil it.
Sorry, dude.
So, like, it's like you're a self-hating Jew, basically, because you are just masochistic.
You know, there's definitely a thing going on, but I think Holocaust reading really does make for a really good summary.
A nice summer read.
You don't want, like, a thriller. I think you really want, you know.
Look, I'm like a sucker for novels set that have some sort of Holocaust, like, theme, a little lost piece of something, you know, like,
isn't
all
that
about
book that.
That
everyone on every airplane ride I take reading, the Anthony Doerr book, that's Holocaust, right? Or it's World War II era, All the Light You Cannot See. Isn't that, yeah, World War II?
Sounds Holocaust
era. But I don't like my Holocaust novelized. I like,
you like the,
I
real,
like, straight
oh no
dope.
I like a little romance, a little intrigue,
a little, like, the Nazi guard, the Jewish,
not that much, not that
the
no,
Jewish
not
rag girl. No, too
Ooh.
Much too
See
much.
Me.
All right, little news of the Jews.
Also,
maybe?
I'm sorry, but, like, it's so much fun to carry these books on the subway because everyone kind of just doesn't make eye contact because you're the weirdo reading about Treblinka on the three.
Is
line,
that
right?
The way to, like, not be bothered? On
yeah,
the subway?
That's exactly the way. Because, like, a popular book, people are like, oh, I read this. Aren't you
and
loving
yeah,
this?
Yeah, you're like, no.
Or, like, some cool book, people are like, oh, yeah, you're so fucking pretentious. You're reading, like, Plutarch.
Juno Barnes. Like,
but, yeah.
Paul Bowles.
But you carry that, like, 700
That's
page.
A tome.
Everyone's sort of like, you're really weird.
No one fist bumps you on the Raoul Hilberg.
If there's, like, a subway preacher, do they avoid, like, do they let you be?
They're like, excuse me very much. I'm trying to oh, never mind. You're not going to give me a dollar. You're in Treblinka right now.
Little news of the Jews?
Little news.
Do we do some NOTJ? Hobby Lobby, the big craft store, the store that I will never set foot in, not just because its owners are right-wing freaks, but there's no universe in which I go to the crafting store.
I was about to say.
It's funny because I actually, like, didn't grow up in a place where there were Hobby Lobbies.
Nor I. They did not move into the North until very recently.
So people are like, oh, this store I went to my whole life now has this, like, you know, they were part of the Supreme Court decision so that they wouldn't have to pay for birth control in their healthcare plans. Like, all of a sudden it would be like, I guess like if Michaels did that.
Right.
Michaels is like my...
That's your crafting
Michaels
store?
Michaels is my boy.
Right. So Hobby Lobby's returning a bunch of valuable Iraqi antiquities that they smuggled out of Iraq with the help of three shady Israeli antiquities dealers. The only news of the Jews here is the shady Israeli antiquity dealers who helped Hobby Lobby
steal...
The only
news here is that how come it didn't happen sooner? Because nothing about the story is news or surprising.
Wait, have you heard what the case name is? I'll read it to you. It's in the Eastern District of New York. Okay, case name is the United States of America v. approximately 450 ancient cuneiform tablets and approximately 3,000 ancient clay bullae.
I love that the V is against the actual tablets.
It's not Hobby Lobby. I mean, but to be honest, like the thing that bothers me most about this is their statement was like, we learned a lot from this. Like, we're new to this because they're starting a museum on the DC Mall. That's like the Museum of the Bible or Biblical something. And so this is presumably for the museum. And
we're new to pillaging.
Yeah, they basically did the really Trump defense, which was like, you know,
I'm not good at this.
We're new to the world of acquiring this stuff and didn't appreciate the complexities of the antiquity.
Right,
process.
When like Shlomo and Yuri were like, "Don't tell anyone. It is not. Need to fill out this form. We didn't know. We thought,
live in a world now where you can be like, I learned a lot from this misstep. And
guys,
you're like,
I've only been stealing antiquities for like a month. I'll get better.
I'm the black market.
So speaking of people who have a lot to learn, North Carolina. Segue alert. North Carolina. Gay Pride schedules their parade for what holiday? If you had to pick one holiday on which to not schedule the parade to make it...
The Fast of Gedalia.
I was just about to say, it's some motherfucking Gedalia.
A minor fast day?
Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur.
Major fast.
Then they realized they messed up, and then the organizers promised to, quote, find a solution. I assume the solution will be move the parade.
Well, they can't. It's too late to move the parade, I think.
So Jews will get their own special...
And they'll march together.
With little stars on, right?
No, how about instead of, like, the gay pride flag, Jews could march with, like, their kittels on? No?
No, but so basically,
a joke for three listeners.
A few rabbis have sort of written about this from North Carolina, and one said, you know, like, we couldn't participate for a long time because it was on Shabbat. And then we actually changed our synagogue rules so that we could be part of community activism on Shabbat. And so we all went. So there's clearly has been, on the side of the Jewish community, and like an interest in getting involved, you know, in being allies and being supportive, and to sort of, you know, I get it. Like the holidays move around,
This is like Raleigh Durham. This is not like
backwoods.
Check
it
against the Jewish calendar.
Is there an Isser though on marching on Yom Kippur?
Well, it's the most. I mean, if it's the most solemn holy day of the year,
the Isser is you should be. You're otherwise occupied.
Like it.
Well, you know, it's a whole day. But it could take 2 hours.
Yeah, like, the 2 to 5 period. That period we're like, what are we going to do? Go into to
guys, 2 to 5 is nap time.
I was about to say.
On Yom Kippur and most Saturdays. Yeah. But it's crazy because the two things could not be more like incomparable. The idea of like this solemn holy day and then this like prideful march. It's just a celebration. And I guess you could turn it somehow.
Although Yom Kippur is supposed to be a joyous day. It really is. I mean, everything's been kind of sealed and done. And
I don't think it's supposed to be a joyous day. Is that your read on it?
It's a Hasidic attitude. I'm not making this shit up.
Like the book is closed.
I believe you
Rosh
have a Rebbe.
Rosh Hashanah is the horrible Rosh day of all.
Yeah.
Ingber told you it's a joyous day? Is that what you're getting
for
now?
Ingber, every day is a
every
joyous day.
Every day is a joyous day.
When is not a joyous day?
Jay-Z's latest album, 444, sparks concern from the Jewish community on the song The Story of OJ. I'm already loving this. Brooklyn's Finest raps. By the way, I think I've talked about this on the show before. It was like a year and a half ago when I figured out that Jay-Z was a reference to the subway lines. Because I'm sitting there on the subway one day and I'm looking, I'm like, do I want the F? And I see that J and Z are.
Yeah.
And it all became.
And you're like, from Marcy to Madison Square?
Yeah, the clouds parted. And I thought, that's why he named himself Jay-Z.
So, in other words, if you were ever a rapper, you'd be the M track?
Yes, I'd be the M45 bus.
That's
what you'd be the Metro North.
Go to LaGuardia, LGA. All right. Anyway, on The Story of OJ.
From Massachusetts to New Haven.
He raps, you want to know what's more important than throwing money away at a strip club? Credit. You ever wonder why Jewish people own all the property in America? This how they did it.
So basically this song, it's sort of like a capitalist ode.
This
a celebration of doing well, basically,
this song
in America.
Is when Jay-Z turns into Susie Orman. He's like, and here's like your Roth IRA is really important. I was like, I don't even care about the vaguely anti-Semitic shit in it. It's such a boring theme for a rap song, man.
Okay, so everyone got up in arms.
Thanks,
people were like, basically, everyone was like, what is this lyric about Jewish people? Like, it kind of came out of nowhere. And then the ATL got involved and they were like, this is anti-Semitic. And then everyone, like, you had to have an opinion. So I feel like for the show, like, I have to have an opinion. And my opinion is that, like, it's icky and I don't know why he did it. But I'm like, not super, I'm not like, this is a big problem in America.
The real big problem in America is that really great rappers become really wealthy and then they run out of shit to rap about. And then they start doing this shit. This is why it really helps to be batshit crazy like Kanye, because at this point you're just rapping about like whatever the universe is telling
you. About the unicorns that dance through your dreams.
It doesn't even matter.
Yeah, and not being like, I'm going to play on like sort of, they're philo-Semitic and also anti-Semitic canards of Jews being good with money and being like successful. And also, Jews maybe go to the strip club. We're not like these upstanding. Like, I'm not trying
to. We're not going to the strip club.
Excuse me, sir.
Excuse me.
Tonight we are going to the strip club.
How dare you?
My exposure to hip hop music is basically, you know, a movie every 2 or 3 years. The last one being Straight Outta Compton, which of course also has, was it Eazy-E or who is it? Which one has the song that's about the Jews and the money?
That's right.
Right. So, I mean, would it be correct to say, oh, hip hop mavens of mine, Stephanie and Liel, is it a trope? Is it in more than two hip hop songs that like the Jews got the money?
Yes.
And there's a supercut on YouTube of basically all rappers, like a bunch of rappers singing about their Jewish lawyers. And it's like, it's this weird thing because you're like, they're singing positively about their Jewish lawyers, but they are also perpetuating a stereotype of Jewish lawyers kind of controlling their money.
You learn from hip hop songs. Women, according to rap music, you know, are really only good for a very limited range of things. If you're really taking your cues from like what rap songs are trying to teach you, I think your whole vision of reality is kind of fucked up.
Jay-Z's in his 40s now. Like, he should be growing up.
That's why his whole new, this album is sort of like his fatherhood, his infidelity. Like, he's like dad on this album.
What's his child's name? Blue?
Yeah. And
Little Baby Blue.
And we don't know baby what Blue, the other two are named
do,
yet.
Do like Uncle Myron, the Jewish, you know, who's always at our...
Your Uncle Myron.
You know Uncle Myron, who's always coming around and telling mommy and daddy how much they can spend, what their allowances are. Do like him. Credit. It doesn't even make sense. You know how they got, like, actually, the way they got to own all the property. First of all, we don't own all the property. See, even as me spouting anti-Semitic canards. But if we did own all the property, I don't
Not
think.
Not all would, the property.
Just most of it. It's like in
credit.
New York City.
Like, what does that even mean? Credit. Just take out a credit card. Then you got all the property.
I'm impressed with my attorney, Bernie. I'm impressed with his influential friends. He's got very big connections, and I follow his directions. Bernie knows his way around, and so I always do what Bernie recommends. I am blessed with my attorney, Bernie.
We have an amazing Jewish guest this week. Jenna Weissman-Joslett is a historian and a professor and a renowned chronicler of Jewish life and culture in America. Her latest book is Set in Stone: America's Embrace of the Ten Commandments. She's also newly a columnist at Tablet, where she's writing about amazing things like the era of the Jewish taxi driver in New York City. Welcome, Jenna.
Delighted to be here.
Professor, I should say.
You can call me Jenna.
So you're off for the summer.
Not really. It's during the summer when I do all my work.
So it's not like, you know, rosé, slushies, like all your students?
No, that'd be nice. But no, working hard.
So the book, the new book, this is your fifth book, sixth book?
I don't know. I don't count.
I think it might be seven.
You know, that's in contrast to Liel, who knows exactly how many books he's written, because I once got it wrong. I once said four and like six.
I was just fucking with you. I don't actually think I know.
You moved in so fast to correct me. Anyway, tell us about the new book, Set in Stone.
So it's a look at the Ten Commandments and how they've circulated through time and how they've really entrenched themselves or insinuated themselves in American life. And the question is, why? What is it about America that finds the Ten Commandments so congenial? And what it is about the Ten Commandments that lends themselves to such entrenchment?
They're kind of in certain circles, they're in ill repute because of Roy Moore down in Alabama, because they become the thing that right-wingers like insist on putting up as monuments.
Yeah, that's now. But the lovely thing about being a historian is you look back then, and for the longest time, the Ten Commandments brought people together, didn't set them apart. And so there's a kind of sad trajectory to the story.
Almost like you're saying that we used to be less stupid in America.
More innocent. How about that?
Yeah.
No?
Simpler times.
More civilized?
more restrained, what do you
mean,
I think.
What do you mean they used to bring people together?
Well, it was one of the few things that Jews and Christians had in common. They were a source of, well, you know, in the absence of an established religion, I think the Ten Commandments did the job really well. Mm-hmm. And now they're a big bone of contention. They're the stuff of litigation. They're associated with people that most of us don't want to associate with.
So. How did that happen? How did they come into this?
Oh, that's such a good question. I don't know. Read the book.
Well, we have.
Our readers will.
There are five or six people out there listening to us right now, or more.
Yeah.
Think of this as the world's largest Barnes & Noble reading.
Uh-huh.
And they haven't, but they're going to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's the question that I grapple with. How did it come to this? How did something that was such a lovely force for togetherness devolve into something that is a source of disunion? And I think it has to do with the changing complexion of America. I think it has to do with the fact that once upon a time, the Ten Commandments were not so coercive. You know, they weren't seen as being imposed. And so I think the combination of the two together renders the Ten Commandments today a bit of a hot spot.
So when did we start displaying Ten Commandments everywhere? Like, when did that become
a thing? Apparently early. I mean, that was the great surprise of the book when I started to take a look at all sorts of iterations and versions of the Ten Commandments. They appear in the form of charm bracelets and bookends and bookmarks and every conceivable aspect of daily life. But I think your question really is, when did they become monumental? When did they become public? And that's in the late 50s, early 60s. When in the wake of that blockbuster, which we still screen every year between Easter and Passover.
What's it called again?
The Ten Commandments.
Wait, quick poll. Have you guys seen the Ten Commandments?
Oh, of course. Charlton Heston.
You've never seen it?
What is wrong with you? He's also never read The Diary of Anne Frank.
Who has never read The Diary?
Mark.
As a principled thing?
No, it was never assigned in junior high when Stephanie read it.
No one's ever read it voluntarily. I read that in nursery school.
It's only been assigned. And the movie thing, it just violates my rule of not seeing movies made before 1970 because they're boring. But, I mean, meanwhile, I've read three of your books. So look, I'm doing my culture vulturing in the right places.
I bet you didn't see the 1923 version either of the Ten Commandments. Now, that's really a movie you have to see.
I didn't even know that existed.
Oh, yeah. I actually had to see it in film school.
So something that was so fascinating about reading your book is, so I, you know, associate the Ten Commandments with those big sort of Christian evangelical displays. But what I almost forgot is that Jewish synagogues were displaying the Ten Commandments for a long time. Like, that was a big part of the decor, almost.
Decor. Interesting choice.
Well, thinking about the congregation in New York City that you wrote about.
It's not a wonderful story. It has to do with a congregation. I think it's actually the first synagogue in New York built as a synagogue. Before then, they inhabited and transformed other spaces. They hired a very up-and-coming architect to design the space and a window along with it. And lo and behold, he comes up with the idea of a window that's circular rather than rectangular, which was the traditional mode. And that occasioned quite the hoo-ha. And I love the fact that the Ten Commandments in 1850 is the stuff of consternation and not the stuff of comedy, you know, and that shul politics erupts on the basis of shape, not on the
basis
of idea.
Because it was like a pie, right? And each...
Well, it's just round, yeah.
And
you can't tell. So each pane of glass presumably contained something. The rub of the story, the conceit, the great takeaway is that the window doesn't exist anymore. The building still survives. The window was vandalized. And what still endures is the shape, the kind of silhouette, which is now ensconced in plastic. But you can't tell exactly how the Ten Commandments would fit. So I actually tried to get up on a ladder in the back of the synagogue and make my way in to see if I could see any kind of remnants. I mean, I had my Indiana Jones moment. And the only thing that I came away with, other than a thankfulness that I was back down on the ground after being on that ladder, was I understood the impact visually of the round. I understood how it might have translated. And it's a very effective device, which is a long-winded way of saying, yes, synagogues have made use of the Ten Commandments in stained glass windows as the stuff of needlework. It adorns the Aron, the Ark. It adorns the body of Torah scrolls. So it has a long history, but it's in America, really, that it comes into its own in a really pronounced, really strong way. And that was the surprise of the book. I mean, who knew that American culture is so rich in stuff relating to the Ten Commandments.
I have a question that could only come from a true Jenna Weissman Joslin nerd like me, someone you know had who read your books with pleasure back in grad school and has since. And you know, so one of your great books, The Wonders of America, is about it's about American popular culture or material culture, or right?
Vernacular.
That's
culture. The fancy word.
That's the word.
That's the word.
And you talk about
this is a deep cut question.
It's a deep cut, and you talk about sort of Jewish aesthetics through the decades, right? And I'm curious. Is there a Jewish – so you talk about, you know, how did Jewish homes look in the 40s versus how did they look in the 50s? And what were the trinkets and what were the tchotchkes and what were the – is there – can you name in the present moment if there's a Jewish aesthetic?
No, you know, and I'm sometimes thinking maybe I should do Wonders too.
Yeah.
You know, I really think about that very often. And I'm not sure that there's enough of a different story to warrant. Maybe the story is in the details, not in the overall picture. So I think a lot about whether the aesthetic remains, as I put it in Wonders, and I know you like that quote, stubbornly second rate. And I think to
love the judginess of it. Like, it's great because historians do need to judge, and you're just like, it's second rate.
So. Yeah, that was the only moment in the entire book, I think, where I was judgy.
And Mark was like, I like this one better.
I like that one.
That's
but,
right.
But so you...
So I
do
think
you
we
notice
become,
one now?
No.
Or we're just Americans now?
No, I think we're much more visually sophisticated, and I think we attend to aesthetic matters with a zeal that, well, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but let me say it anyway. We attend to aesthetic matters with a knowingness and a zeal that I think our ancestors did not. I also think we're far more fragmented. We're more culturally divided. So if I were to say that the aesthetic in one community is the prevailing one, that would hold true for that community, not across the board.
Well, the place you could do that book is in the Orthodox community, is in the From community, because they have looks, and we get mail on that. I mean, we talk about that, and then we get mail from them who say, "Yeah, we do." Like, there's, you know, I mean, they have their fashions that come and go in wigs, in long sleeved shirts.
Right.
And,
but then you also have the sort of Jonathan Adler mod pop Judaica aesthetic, which is like Palm Beach, but like you can't really tell that it's a menorah, but there's spaces for the candles. So like, I don't know. I think it's kind of fascinating what's going on now.
Yeah. One thing I would say is that the Ten Commandments probably wouldn't appear in anybody's home these days, and certainly not on a wrist and not in a painting.
Oh, I wonder, but what about like a good tattoo?
Like a
tattoo?
Like
I've seen a dare. I've seen tattoos. Yeah,
of all 10 or just like a favorite one?
No, the shape. It's all about the shape. You know, it's not about the content, which is something I've been discovering.
The two tablet thingies.
Thingy, the round topness of it.
Well, it's funny because we're obviously called tablet, and that is,
How did that happen?
Because of the original, everyone thinks we're like a magazine for tablet readers, for like e-readers, but we're like, no, we're the old tablets.
Ah, clever.
And even on some of our like imagery, we use that same, you know, the two
tablets.
I actually
don't know that there were tablets when we launched tablet.
No, it was pre-tablet.
It was pre-tablet.
Mm-hmm. Post OG tablet, OT tablet. But yeah, I mean, I think it's still such a resonant visual image.
Right. And I think increasingly it became the public face of American Judaism, American Jews. I don't think it always was. And so the point of the book really is how the Ten Commandments changed their stripes, not their contents, but their stripes. And they circulate through history and they expand their impact and they contract and they have a life like any other.
And yet we still pay attention to the content.
Yeah.
Don't we?
Can we name them?
I think we could at least some.
Wait, let's try this.
Thou shalt not kill.
No, wait.
I think we should do
so there are all these surveys. Stephen Prothero loves these surveys, of course, on his how religiously illiterate we are, right? That you can stand at the door of the biggest evangelical megachurch and just grab someone coming out who's like sweating with piety and say, name the Ten Commandments, and they can get what, 3, 4 if you're lucky
on
a good day?
3 or 4.
All right, so here we go. You ready? Who wants to try this? Liel, are you going to try this or Stephanie?
I already gave one. Thou shalt not kill.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you did kill. Great.
Kill. Okay.
Really.
Let's see. Wait, can you name them all?
Covet.
You can't?
You know why? Because there are different versions.
There are different versions, right.
The Catholic, the Protestant. You know, I actually boned up. I knew you were going to ask
me
that.
Let's do the Jewish version.
No, I can't. Okay.
I'm going to rock the Hebrew. So, Lo Tisach Shem Elohim Lashav, right? So you do not carry my name in vain.
Name in vain. Okay.
Which one is that?
That is the first, I believe.
Oh, now you want the numbers?
No, not the first.
The first is I am your God.
But is that an actual commandment or is that a preamble to the Constitution?
Well, okay. The Protestants and Catholics think it's a preamble. The Jews hold it as number one, don't we?
Then that would be number one.
Okay.
So they add a different one?
Yeah, I can definitely not do them in order.
The math is different. It's so hilarious.
So they have the 13 commandments. We have coveting.
We ain't got to Moshiach. All right?
Coveting. We have lote anebera chayit sheker. You should not.
Covet.
Is it? Your name in vain. There's lot chamod, which is thou shall not covet. Lot isa shem adonai lashav, which is don't take the name in vain.
Okay. Does there have no other gods but me?
Yeah, that's up there.
Isn't that I am your God? No, it's a separate one. No other gods.
Okay.
These are like sub bullets.
Lote anebera chayit sheker is don't bear false witness or false testament.
Lying, right?
It doesn't say lying.
I know, but that's
that's the import.
There's honor thy father and mother, which is my least favorite commandment, obviously.
Keep Shabbat.
Right, Zechot Yom HaShabbat.
I did not know that was a commandment.
How many you got?
Shabbat is a commandment. I'm not doing well.
I think we're up to eight.
It's a thing we're doing?
I think we're up to eight.
Did we get covet?
We got covet.
Many times.
What are we missing, Jenna?
I don't know.
You don't know what we're missing?
What do we got?
I am your God. Don't take my name in vain.
Graven image.
Graven image.
Thank you, historian. Stubbornly second rate American Jewish.
We have to.
Speaking of graven images.
We have to go in a sec. Can I?
But we're unorthodox. We got nine out of ten. Come on.
We should make our own commandments. Thou shalt listen every Thursday morning.
Thou shalt download on Thursday. That's right. Okay. Jenna Weissman-Joslett, set in stone, America's embrace of the Ten Commandments.
One final question. What's your favorite commandment?
Do not covet.
Yeah.
There we go. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Great fun. Thank you all.
Hear me. Oh, hear me. All pay heed. The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15. Ten commandments for all to obey.
All right, listen, we have some live shows coming up, and we are doing four at the JCC Manhattan, which is our uptown location, site of our sold-out show last year. The next one is soon. Okay, soon. Sound effect for soon. July 25th. That's right, Tuesday, July 25th. The Jew of the Week will be 538.com political prognosticator Harry Enten. And our guest Gentile will be Harun Mogul, who is Muslim, but also a fellow at the Great Jewish Center of Learning, the Shalom Hartman Institute. He's a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations, and he's the author of the new book, How to Be a Muslim. You may have heard him on Fresh Air. If every person who heard him on Fresh Air buys a ticket to come see him in person, we will sell 12 million tickets.
See you there, Terry.
See you there, Terry. Listen, two great guests, special prizes, possibly more guests, lots of hugs from us. We'll stay after to schmooze. We'll go out for drinks. JCC of Manhattan, Upper West Side, Tuesday, July 25th.
We'll be drinking on stage, most likely.
7:30 p.m. Tickets ain't that expensive. Go to jccmanhattan.org and click on Arts and Ideas. Please come. Hey, everyone, listen, we asked for your help on the camp stories, and you gave us help. If you heard the camp episode, you guys sent us a lot of stories. Our listeners are our best writers, in fact. You guys have better stories than we do. So I want to ask you for three more things. First of all, we're doing another apology episode for Yom Kippur this year. So if any of you has good stories of apologies that you've made, apologies not accepted, apologies thwarted, apologies that didn't go well, send them to unorthodox@tabletmag.com.
It's not too late to say sorry.
It's never too late to say sorry. Second.
That was a Justin Bieber reference.
Yeah. I didn't get that. Thank you. You saw in my face
I was like,
that it didn't flicker. There was no flicker.
Nope.
Second, our writer Jonathan Zalman is on the road. Where's he going? His end point is North Dakota. Is that where he's going?
He's going everywhere.
He's taken his dog. What's his dog's name?
Lady. Oh, the best.
He's taken Lady the Black Lab, and he's on the road crossing America looking for interesting Jewish stories. So if you're somewhere in middle America and you'd like to introduce Jonathan Zalman to like the craziest Jew or the craziest Jew story in town or whatever, again, email us unorthodox@tabletmag.com. We will pass the word on. And third, I just thought this would be a great opportunity. We've decided we're doing a nose job episode. I bet some of our listeners have just thoughts on nose jobs. Yours, your sisters, your fathers, your mothers.
The one you didn't get.
The one you didn't get, the one you're planning to get. Let us decide for you if you should have one. The answer is no. Maybe, I don't know, maybe.
No, you can't. You're doing that thing where you're just like conscripting upon people what you think.
You're right.
People can do it.
We're not here to judge. Do what you want. The point is.
You and your gourmet dog can walk right into the rhinoplasty office.
The point is we need Yom Kippur
anecdotes. Nostril normativity.
We need Yom Kippur anecdotes and Jonathan Zalman opportunities and nose job stories. Unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Hit us up. We read and respond to all mail, mostly.
God.
I'm so happy.
This is amazing. Hi. This is just so amazing.
Hi. Carol's setting up her robot cats, right? Are these technically robots?
They are.
Okay, everyone. This is a delightful.
Like,
yes, we have two cats here in the studio. We also have Carol Wilburn. She is a renowned cat therapist, a cat expert. She's published 6 books on cat psychology and has treated more than 13,000 cats with the Wilburn Way, which, you know, deals with both cats and their owners, and even incorporates Reiki. We are so happy to have you here. There, oh. And you brought cats, which is like, you're my favorite guest we've ever had. They're little mechanical cats. One is black. That's Ziggy Stardust. Then we have Casanova, who is more of like a tabby?
Yeah, an orange. Yeah, an orange tabby. Yeah, or an orange tiger.
I have to apologize. You requested a cat, a real cat, be in the studio.
Yeah.
And I am unable to bring my cat, Cat Stevens, who listeners know
because
about.
Because he's a violent
maniac. He's a little bit of a problem cat.
Oh, he probably needs my help, I think.
He definitely needs your help.
Yeah. He needs your help worse than any
he
cat
needs your help,
ever
and
seen.
I need your help.
Is he your only cat?
Yes.
It's probably part single cat syndrome he's aggressive.
But my apartment's so small, I can't get another cat.
Oh, it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter.
Now, here's what we would like to ask you. We'd like to show you a quick video of Cat Stevens, Stephanie's cat.
Sure.
And then we would like your professional opinion.
Sure.
Because we've been offering unprofessional advice to Stephanie.
And it's gotten her nowhere.
For a very long time. Most of it would terrify you because we think you should get rid of the cat. And so we would love a professional's opinion.
So I have a cat. He's about 3.5. His name is Cat Stevens.
What color is it?
He is a gray domestic short hair.
Does that matter, therapeutically speaking?
No, I just thought your listeners would like to know.
They've seen pictures of him. He is my favorite thing in the entire world, but he is a little bit of a monster.
Uh-huh.
He used to attack me. I mean, I hesitate to tell you this. He is on Prozac.
Uh-huh.
Used to attack
me. Is it working?
Yes, it works a lot. I mean, I used to have my arms used to be covered in bites.
But it's not totally working.
Not totally working. And he just, like, we'll be lying on the couch and he'll just come up and just, like, start biting you. And I don't know what...
Because you're his cat. He needs something to play with. So how big is your apartment?
Pretty small.
How small?
Like, twice the size of this studio. It's a cozy West Village.
Oh, it's big. If it's twice the size of this room.
That's true. But there's 3 of us, me and my fiancé and the cat.
But you both work, right?
Yes. So he's alone all day.
Yeah. So, it's not like you both work at home.
No, we are at home sometimes working.
Well, I hope so. I really need another cat. Nothing else is going to solve it.
My mom is going to hate this.
Why? Does she live there?
No.
So why should she care?
You're right. So this is part of what you do, right? You treat both the cat and the patient.
Yeah, family.
I was about to say, can we just talk to you about our lives? Forget the cats. Can I just share with you?
Mom, I'm gonna get Carol.
It's family therapy.
Tell me. I'm dead serious here. Tell me about the training. You know, how do you?
I majored in psychology.
But how do you gain the insight into cat? I mean, some of it is observation. Some of it is
having
gift,
a cat practice,
right?
And seeing all these cats. Before then, I just helped people find homes for cats.
Right, but a lot of other people spend a lot of time with cats and don't have your insight.
But I don't see lots of cats. Can you imagine cats coming in all the time and you had to figure out?
I absolutely cannot.
I had to figure out.
That is my worst nightmare.
Oh, okay. I had to figure out what to do because maybe their home going to be given up or they were going to be put down.
Is there a moment that you remember early on in a career in which you understand that you have this gift, this insight, you observe something and then you do something and the cat's behavior changes? Is there like a kind of eureka moment for you?
I think the eureka or the epiphany was just that I liked them so much and wanted to help them. And I realized that when I attempted to do something, it worked.
What are 3 big mistakes that people make with their cats?
With some people, they feel that the cat doesn't need that much attention. And so they'll go away for weekends and just puts down some food and think, well, cat's independent, it's going to be okay. And sometimes the cats will get sick, and that's a problem. And then sometimes the cats will be, in their inimitable way, giving communication that things aren't so great, but the person won't recognize it.
By, for example, mauling you.
No, I'm talking about subtle.
Okay.
Subtle. maybe the tail's just going all the time and the ears are flattening. And maybe they're eating too much, or they're not eating enough, or they're crying a lot. See, that's kind of subtle. But then if the person doesn't realize it, then the cat has to step up a bit. So then maybe it could become aggression. It could become not using the litter box. It could become being very destructive. If you can't recognize the signs, then it could, you know, really be...
Stephanie, are you feeling judged right now?
No, I'm actually feeling this like very warm. I feel like you are a very non-threatening, non-judgmental presence, which is really nice. I mean, I've had a veterinary behaviorist in my house. I've sort of done the whole thing. And a lot of that has made me like, oh, you know, this idea that I should be doing more, like this, that I'm doing something wrong. That's been a lot of my stress and my shame that I feel like I'm not parent enough for this cat.
Yeah, I think that you're doing enough, but you can't do it all. And when one can't do it all, then you need help. So you did. You got professional help. But somehow, if someone gave you the answer, you skipped right over it. And really what it is your cat is single cat syndrome. And he treats you like he would treat another cat. He could go over and jump on another cat. They could wrestle. And that would be fine. But that doesn't work with you.
He does groom me, though.
Well, that's okay. But that could lead into biting.
Yeah, though, it does. It does.
Because the energy builds. So getting the right cat, and if you got a cat that preferred cats to people, then you wouldn't even have to worry about giving the cat attention.
Wow. So now you do house visits. So do you walk into a house and just know everything you need to know, like right away before you even?
I ask a few questions before, you know, on the phone and by email. And I usually, you know, have a good feeling of, you know, what's happening.
What is the most extreme case you've ever seen?
One that was very difficult, and it all worked out. It's a happy ending. A psychiatric pediatrician got in touch with me because he had three cats. His partner had passed on, and his cat started taking it out on the two cats that were mainly his late partner's cats, and it got so bad that the two cats had been living in a kitchen cabinet for the past year. He did seek help, and he had them on drugs, and that didn't work. And his veterinarian finally said, get in touch with Carol. So slowly but surely, the cats came out of the cabinet, and now they're all living together.
Hold on. So you come into this house, and there are two cats in the cabinet. What do you do?
One of the things is I play music for calming. I also do Reiki, which it relieves stress. It balances mind, body,
and spirit.
Is it a form
of massage?
It's placements. It's not really massage. It's just light placement.
You do Reiki for the cats?
I will usually give the person a short treatment because the cats get a contact high. Most cats don't like it if you're just holding your hands on them. You could also distant Reiki is just by doing mental symbols. But anyway, all is happy now.
And what music, by the way, do cats?
I usually use New Age and usually flute and sounds of different animals and fish. And I also have other sounds to help desensitize. So what I do is I appeal to all of their senses, the Wilburn way of appealing to all their senses. And I have a monthly blog, free blog on my site, which is thecattherapist.com. And I've written several books, and my blog is The Wilburn Way. And I would really like to help you help your cat. Because there is an answer, and you could all really be living very happily.
Do you believe that there are some cats? Well, this is another way of asking the same question about people,
sure,
right? But do you believe that there are some cats that are like beyond redemption?
I think some cats might take a really long time to reach the redemption.
But you don't believe any are inherently evil?
No, I think they're inherently frightened and threatened, and even with frightened, threatened people, these are the ones who, you know, fill, unfortunately, a lot of our institutions. It's fear, and fear can go a lot of ways. Fear can either make you attack or retreat. It's fight or flight. And it's much easier to live with something that's in flight.
Was there a point in which you said, you know, I'm just going to make a hell of a lot more money if I do the same thing for people?
Well, I'm actually helping the people. It's family or interspecies therapy.
No, I know, but you could be like $375 an hour, like for 30 minutes on the Upper East Side, easily just talking to, you know, that never occurred to you that you're just going to do humans exclusively?
I like helping the people help the cats because then the cats help the people and everybody's happy. Sometimes I do dogs. I could do anything. It's all about emotions.
What are the inherent emotional differences between cats and dogs?
I think it's just that with the dog, usually likes to please whoever he or she lives with. Where first the cat pleases him or herself, and then can please the person.
That's why I do like cats, because cats are conditional. Like, dogs love you unconditionally, but there's something about like cats that they play hard to get a little bit.
Sid says that our cat doesn't like me because I treat her like I would treat a dog, like I treat our dog. That I want our cat to be a dog, which is true. I want the cat to like romp with me, and I want to throw the cat around. And the cat's just not.
Cat's on her own terms.
The cat's not generous with me that way.
Yeah. Well, cat has other priorities. I think that's. I also bought some toys.
Ooh.
I endorse
Multi-Pet
International.
They're
toys,
fun,
so
creative, and durable. Oh, I like this.
Yeah, they're fun.
And can they take this home for my cat?
Yeah, you can.
Really?
Yes, you can take it wherever you want.
So now
the robot
that,
cats are moving again.
Speaking of robot cats, now that we're in like the internet era, are people always sending you like memes of cats and videos of cats?
Oh, yeah.
And do you like them?
Some of them I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah.
So like you, like the rest of us, are also watching cat videos on the internet
all day. I
do.
And I take a lot of them because I use them on my blog and I use them, you know, for demos. And
Casanova likes Leo.
Stephanie, are you going to get another cat?
I really think you should.
I would love another cat. My worry is that then I have a drama between two cats. Like,
you won't, not
right
if it's
cat.
The right cat.
How do you know?
Also, I'm worried about having...
I can help you with that.
Okay. Ben is going to really love this.
Yeah, Ben Cohen.
So, the other thing that the cat does is it possible that since the cat is mine and now I live with another man, he resents him?
He doesn't resent him, but he just feels left out.
Sometimes he'll just smack him in the forehead.
How would you feel if you know, you're living with Ben and then he brought home another woman? You'd feel a little left out.
I would not like that.
Yeah,
I would not like that
thing.
At all.
Although it depends on the woman, I assume.
Yeah.
And like,
he's always talking about this girl, Steph Curry.
There you have it. But if Steph Curry came to live with you.
What is something that you found that you could tell cats and you also tell people? Like, what's the most common thread between the two?
Is just to be aware of what the other is doing and why the other is doing it. Like the cat on
Casanova.
If the cat wants to eat all the time, maybe it's not getting enough attention and it's stuffing its feelings, and maybe you need to spend more time playing with your cat.
Carol Wilburn, thank you so much for coming
in. It's been fun.
Cat therapist.
Thank you. Yes.
Amazing.
Cat therapist.
Absolutely
to the stars
amazing.
Of the cats.
Fun.
Everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who knows where it's at.
Tell me, everybody's picking up on that feline beat, because everything else is obsolete.
Strictly high button shoes.
A square with a horn makes you wish you weren't born.
Give a dime a place.
But with a square in the act, you can set music back.
So, guys, you might remember that our editor, Noah, is on Birthright. And, you know, that is this beautiful time for Jewish growth. And we thought we'd just check in with him and see what's going on. Noah, how is it? How's the Holy Land?
It's amazing. Yeah, it is almost indescribable. I mean, we've just been all over, like, driving in the bus several hours a day. So we see everything and... it's just a beautiful, beautiful country.
What I remember from my Birthright trip is they never let us sleep. Like, we were on the bus at 7 a.m., then we were going, and then we were asleep at midnight, and they woke us up at 6 to eat, like, salad for breakfast.
Yeah.
I just remember being so tired. Is that
well,
the...
like, they can indoctrinate you more easily.
Right, exactly. It's like sleep deprivation is
hilarious.
Part of the brainwashing.
My intellectual defenses are really down right now. I am one more two-hour night of sleep away from making Aliyah.
Okay, are you eating and are you making friends?
Yes to both. The people here are great. So I'm like with 40 other, I will say mostly Reform Jews and not even, like half-Jews, and basically people who didn't grow up, a lot of people who didn't grow up with, like, Jewish traditions, or people who sort of their parents let them decide, and they ultimately kind of didn't have much of anything in the way of religious education growing up. So for a lot of us, or sort of something like an awakening.
When I went on Birthright, the thing that most surprised me was actually most people on the trip knew nothing about Judaism or Israel and actually were there to, like, really soak up as much as they could.
Yeah, that's definitely the case here. In fact, actually, we're about to start this little bar mitzvah ceremony for those of us that didn't have it when we were 13.
Are you getting bar mitzvahed?
I am already bar mitzvah, so today I'm just a proud parent.
Oh, so, that's so exciting.
You know, I never became a bar mitzvah, and they didn't have that option on my birthright trip.
Oh, like, it was amazing. It was really moving.
It was really moving?
Yeah.
And is it optional, or is it like, hey, we're feeding
yes,
you?
Yes, it's optional. It's optional.
But everyone who, like, pretty much everyone I would say who hasn't been bar mitzvah probably does it. Because you're, like, so drawn to this spirit.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it is really, like, warm and fuzzy bunch of people. Even the IDF, like, we joined, it's, like, 40 American Jews and 7 IDF. And I just want to report that Israelis are not rude. Israelis are some of the sweetest people. I'm really surprised and impressed.
No, I'm totally with you there. I've never gotten the rude vibe. I know people do, but I'm totally with you there. What? So this is day what of your trip, Noah?
Day 8.
Day 8. As far as you know, the sleep deprivation scrambles it all. What has the highlight been?
You know, I will say, so wherever I go, it really is the people. So people look at the we have to wear our Taglit lanyards, our birthright lanyards, like everywhere we go, and people see them, and like 4 or 5 religious Jews have come up to me and told me I should make Aliyah because they see the lanyard, and I cannot imagine another country where people see groups of American tourists and ask them, please move here.
Yeah, most people are like, Americans, get away. Yeah. Have you done Bedouin Tent Night, most importantly?
We did Bedouin Tent Night the other night. That was great. I rode on a camel for about 5 minutes.
What Stephanie's really asking is,
did it go down?
Did any future, were shidduchim made, any future marriages begin on Bedouin Tent Night?
You know, Mark, I think that's a little not something I want to talk about. No, I'm just kidding. Uh-huh. No, there's nothing funny went on Bedouin Tent Night. But you know, I'm in Israel for another couple months.
But you're saying what happens on the bus stays on the bus.
That's right. What happens in the Holy Land? Yeah.
Noah, I can hear your birthright glow from here. Thank you for checking in with us.
Could you send us a selfie and sext us a picture of tan buff Sabra Noah for the newsletter?
Yeah, you got it. Miss you guys.
Miss you too, Noah.
Miss you too. Thank God we have your mom here to edit the show this week.
Okay, bye. Tell mom I say hi. Hi, mommy. I'm having
she's
fun.
She's waving.
She's waving proudly.
She made us challah. Did she make you challah growing up? Or
actually,
is this
your dad
first,
made it. Like, she brought it.
Okay.
That's right.
Dad.
It smells so delicious. You would love
she
it.
Brought, Warren. She brought you All right. Kala?
Yeah, she yeah. loves us. You're out. Great. We're in.
Don't right. worry. She has plenty of kids to take care of. You stay in Israel, okay? We'll keep the Levinson family home fires burning. Thanks, Noah.
Happy to hear it. All right. See you guys later.
Bye. Love, Noah. So this would be an opportune time to say that our editor this week is Debbie Gallant, mother of
Noah Levinson.
Of Noah Levinson.
I like this. Like, we really keep it in the family. Noah was going on birthright, and we're like, we need another editor. Let's just get your mom.
Let's get your
she's,
mom.
She's a great editor. And best of all, she said, you know, she comes bearing carbs. She brought a challah that her husband Warren made for us. And I'm just like really, really all about it.
I've always had a fancy to ride upon a camel. To ride upon a camel like a sheep.
Like a sheep, like a sheep, like a sheep.
I rode through the Sahara on a brute they call Cascara. But gee, I only stuck it for a week. Click, clack, click. There ain't no kick. Riding on a camel.
Hey, Hey, we'd like to welcome our new listeners and our new newsletter subscribers. First of all, a big shout out to, we have a lot of new listeners. We've been getting a lot of mail from people who say like, oh, I just discovered your podcast. And we love that mail. Thank you for writing to us. Particularly good one from South African Wayne Sussman, who says that we're big in South Africa. And we're the talk of many bar mitzvahs and brisses. And I like the idea that we're the talk of South African brisses. And so thank you. We have several new newsletter subscribers. This week, we'd like to welcome the law firm of Amy Koo, Cassidy Levy, and Lauren Cohen. Amy Koo? Do you guys have any thoughts on who Amy Koo is? I do, but I don't know if you... Well, I think that Amy Koo used to be Amy Weinstein, and her fiancé was Herschel Dubenfeld. But they couldn't decide if they should be the Weinstein Dubenfelds, so they decided to just choose the name Koo, because they coo at each other a lot. And that's their sort of their language, their love language. Coo, coo. So they are the coos.
I thought it had something with a coup d'etat, which is way more where my head is.
That's
at
where your head, my head is at, yeah. Cooing, and yours is at
Amy
at
coup d'etat.
Anyway, we're glad to have Amy Koo to get our newsletter, and also her husband Herschel Nay Dubenfeld Koo. To get our newsletter, sign up at our website tabletmag.com or send an email to unorthodox@tabletmag.com and be forewarned that we may make fun of your name. Okay, the mailbox. Okay, I'm gonna do some quick bites from some amazing letters. This one begins, "Hey there, my favorite podcasters, Eva. Last week, our family had to unexpectedly say goodbye to our best furry friend, a cattle dog terrorist mix named Tucky Shalom. Being one of those who prefer the company of dogs to most people, this loss has been particularly anguishing, with the guilt levels hovering near abnormal, even for a Jewess. In the midst of this grief, I knew I could turn to my trusted unorthodox peeps to provide some comic relief. Side note, Mark, I agree that shelter dogs are the best, and that's all we've ever had. Designer dogs are way goyisha, unless, as I believe Butnick said, there are allergies. Actually, I said that.
Yeah, everyone's saying that I said that.
It was my caveat.
Once we finish this letter, I'm going to tell you how I feel about this.
Okay. However, the letter goes on, you are really hard on Barbara. That's Streisand. I've never heard you get quite so fired up before. Christ on skates. Just remember, she's a member of the tribe, and we got to band together, Mark, not tear each other down. There are way worse people to go after than a beloved Jewy songstress with an expensive dog habit. Dana in Chicago. P.S. Please say hi to my second favorite Israeli for me, Anil Hevet Liel.
So you guys, we have not had a chance to break down the dog discussion where Mark just like threw down against, he called them gourmet dogs, which gourmet sounds dogs. Like dogs you're eating. But well, whatever. Yeah. But so, and everyone said that I said the allergy thing. I did not.
I said that. I said if
because
you have allergies,
it's
okay.
Here's the thing. And I'm, you know, this is a theory from our editor-in-chief, Alana. You say Jews are the mutts of the dog world. That is not true at all. Jews are like the purebreds of the world. We are inbred, which is why we have all these diseases. It's like Jews married Jews in tiny communities for thousands and thousands
of
years.
We're basically bulldogs.
Yeah, and so it's like, yeah, we can't. Yeah, you can't take us on planes. Yeah, we'll like, you know. Right. But so
maybe we're the service dogs of the dog world.
So, but I just, you know, and I got a lot of letters from dogs. My dog Teddy was upset.
So Jews should be getting purebreds because
no, Jews should do whatever they want, and you shouldn't. Be
Jews
telling
have suffered
them
enough,
what
Mark
to do. Like,
insert reformed Jewish
yes,
joke here.
Obviously,
Jews should do whatever they
rescue
want.
Rescue dogs is great, but you can't like. I just the level of vitriol you have for people who have.
Oh, but come on! It's also about the kind of people who have purebred dogs.
No, and that's the kind of person you hate. We like that. That's like even.
I'm not running from this. There you go.
But I think it's more. It's actually about you, and it's not about the dogs.
No, it's about them.
I don't know. I heard from Liesl. She's a Bernedoodle. She was upset.
The dogs wrote to you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I heard from several dogs.
Next letter. This one's in a nice attack on me. This will go well. The sponsor mentions lately for AT&T have been memorable because Mark keeps pronouncing the word for a billion bytes as gigabyte, as if my bytes will be so happy to flow through AT&T's network that they dance a jig. One episode from a few weeks ago had him saying the proper gigabyte, but it seems he's back to his old or simply pre-recorded ways. I'll let Mark call me a Jewess if he'll say gigabyte. Thanks, Elizabeth Lowe, Chicago. First of all, why all the hateration from Chicago? I don't even understand.
I know,
letter like, after letter from Chicago. Second.
Just go to Taste of Chicago.
As one writer pointed out, obviously I say gigabyte because Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future says gigabyte. And
see, I think this is like the gif dilemma
well,
of our
knows
time.
That.
I
think so too.
This is like, you keep saying gigabyte. It makes me laugh.
Here's a Stephanie letter. Hello, Unorthodox family. I felt compelled to write after the Stephen episode when poor Stephanie was made fun of for having a difficult last name. We didn't make fun of her. We love-bombed her for it. As a Lifshitz who went to Jewish school growing up, I was teased constantly. When I asked my assorted Lifshitz...
The Lifshitz? Really?
When I asked my assorted Lifshitz relatives what to do with it, they all responded with, "Don't worry, it will change when you get married." There's an answer for you. Imagine
you're
my
girl. It's fine.
Imagine my surprise when I grew up and discovered that in Quebec, women don't change their names when they get married. So I'm stuck with this no matter what. So, Stephanie, more power to you for choosing not to change your name, and mazal tov on the upcoming nuptials.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Thanks to all of you for the laughs and for building a podcast community. I like to think of it as a pod. It's not a podcast house, it's a podcast home.
Yeah, it's a tent.
It's a tent. It's a Bedouin podcast
tent. I love the, so, yeah, Lifshitz. The problem is like here. Your most famous Lifshitz changes name.
Ralph
so
Lauren.
You're like, yeah. You don't have the.
What's
the,
great about the Ralph Lauren is all of his cousins change their names too. There's always like random Laurens who like own candy stores and dog.
Well, that's his daughter.
Well, what, but there's like his siblings who became Laurens. Yeah. It's like.
It's crazy.
It's cray cray.
But I, you know, there is a Lifshitz invited to my wedding. That's like, that's bad too. But you know what? Look, I like pride and bad last names.
Yep.
It's a Jewish thing.
Saul Nachshon wrote to us, "Hi. I was introduced to your show by my girlfriend, and I'm so happy that she did. The notes on camp really nailed everything I loved and didn't love about summer camp. I'm still good friends with my camp friends today. But falling in love with camp did not come easy. Like Mark, I started at Camp Kinderland and had a miserable time." Yes, Saul. "When Mark said that it seemed like the people there, for the most part, were assholes, I could not stop laughing. That was my memory, too," and there are 4 exclamation points. "One specific thing Mark didn't mention was we did have a color war, and it lasted for a week, except instead of colors, each team was named after causes. I believe I was on Team Abolitionists, while my brother was on Team Nuclear Disarmament, and my friend was on Team Anti-Intervention / Sanctuary Movement. And yes, like Mark said, after a week-long effort of team competition, it all ended in a Kinderland tie. Thanks so much for vindicating my bad memories of Camp Kinderland." I love that we're ganging up on Camp Kinderland.
The only color war in Camp Kinderland is between the color red and the color red.
Okay, another camp listener. "Dear Unorthodox, just wanted to write in since I also, like Mark, went to Farm and Wilderness. The five freedoms, remember the fifth freedom is freedom from clothes, were definitely still a thing, although most campers didn't partake of the fifth except for the last day, which involved a massive game in the mud and a nighttime dip. One boy with a major Jew fro figured he'd be super cool by dyeing his hair multiple colors until finishing and realizing that it made him look like a clown. Camp is weird. Yours, Amory Meltzer." You know what's weird? A Jew named Amory. There's a great name for it. A-M, it's like armory without the first R. You're going to understand a second why I read this letter. It won't be immediately apparent, but "Dear J. Crew, I'm a Reform rabbi and a big fan. However, your latest podcast had me saying F U Liel out loud to my phone at 7:45 in the morning.
Hello.
The Union for Reform Judaism has been running summer camps since 1951. With approximately 20 camps across North America, URJ operates the largest, most successful Jewish camping program in the world. And URJ camps are actually pretty Jewy. I grew up at Goldman Union Camp Institute. Gucci, one of URJ's first camps and still one of its best. It's where my parents went and where I fell in love with being Jewish. It's a big part of what put me and so many others on the path to becoming a rabbi. L'shalom, Rabbi Emma Gottlieb."
We got a lot of hate from people who said we didn't talk about Reform camps, but we actually had a lot of Camp
Hart,
Camp
who
Gucci.
Went to Gucci.
I went to Gucci. I just love there's a camp
but
called
people
Gucci.
People really got mad about that.
Okay, next camp letter. "Dear Jewcasters, a great episode. However, no Gaga? Please rectify."
Oh, yeah, the Gaga saga.
So Tablet has run articles on the Jewish origins of the game Gaga. And, this letter continues brilliantly. "I went to Arthur Rita JCC camp and Galil Habonim camp in Pennsylvania, as well as many years at Quaker Maoist work camp in Nova Scotia."
Work camp.
So I just wanted to, I thought I went to bad camps. There's actually a Quaker Maoist
labor camp.
Labor camp.
In Nova Scotia. Actually, okay. "As an adult, I cooked at Farm and Wilderness while there was still nudity." Brilliant. "See you at Jabotinsky Lake Martini Lounge. Max Moggin, West Marlboro,
amazing.
Vermont." And finally, our best letter of the week, in a week with so many good letters. "Dear incredible people far, far away, I'm a 26-year-old Jewess. Yes, that's what my girlfriends and I refer to ourselves as. We even have a WhatsApp group called Jewesses. I was raised in a traditional Ashkenazi..."
By the way, Mark, if you're listening, Mark would like to be on that group.
Totally would. "I was raised in a traditional Ashkenazi Jewish household, went to a Jewish school, had a bat mitzvah, did taglit, and a masa gap year program. Now, as a young secular Jew, I flat out rejected synagogue and keeping kosher after I became an adult at 13. Besides attending limited Jewish events on offer for young Jewish professionals, parenthesis, sad singles events where you've seen everyone on J-Swipe before, celebrating high holidays and Shabbat dinner food comas, I'm still figuring out what sort of Jew I am and how I see my future as a Jewish woman. This podcast has been a divine revelation for me." Divine. "Not since Broad City did I realize that a cool Jew is not an oxymoron." And she spelled realize the Australian way with an S. "You guys rock. You are my Jewish education post-school. I even recommend you to my mom." Oh, the Australianness is strong in this one. "And now she has become one of your biggest fans. She even asks me every week if I've listened to your latest podcast. If you find me a nice Jewish boy, I'll finally be able to get my mom off my back, and she will advertise on your program in the Southern Hemisphere for life. Regards, Gabby Oberman.
I love this. And anything that compares us to Broad City is like the best thing anyone can
say. Amazing. We will not reach those levels of greatness, but Mazel Tovs, Stephanie?
I got some shout outs. Can I do that?
Sure.
I have a shout out to, I think, the aforementioned Lauren Cohen, who is actually Ben Cohen's, those Cohen's best family friend are the other Cohen's. And so she started listening and she's like gone way through our archive. And it's like, she'll be like texting me about funny things I said two years ago.
2 years ago. And you're like, what?
And it's amazing. So welcome. Oh, I also have a shout out to Stephanie Obler, who is the mother of a friend of my brother-in-law, Cliff Silverman, but listens to the podcast. And I figured it out through Instagram and, you know, small world. So
small world.
Just, you know, Instagram brings miracles. And the last shout out is to Molly Yeh, our former guest, beloved. Mascot of the podcast.
Who's become friends with my brother, Jonathan, which is amazing.
Does that make you a little bit jealous?
Jonathan and I have had words about this, but they exchange bagel recipes.
So speaking of that, you know, earlier in the year, I mean, when we had her on, she said there's no bagels in Lox where she lives in Grand Forks. And she's actually going to Alaska this week. To like fish salmon to make her own smoked salmon. So like more power to her.
Yeah.
So you're now number two on the list of Oppenheimer's Molière may one day marry.
Right. I mean,
I feel a little bit.
Thank God her husband doesn't listen to the show or follow her on Twitter. So he knows
or
nothing
that your
about
daughter
this.
Is in the next room.
Right. Oh yeah. Okay. Liel, Mazel Tov.
My Mazel Tov is to Jenna Singer, who is the director of the JCC summer camp where my kids go. And if only every aspect of the universe was run as competently and as wonderfully as that camp, we would have peace and prosperity. It's just, you know, what a pleasure to walk in and see something that's just full of joy and order.
And competently run.
You know?
Yeah, amazing. My Mazel Tovs, I'm going to hand them off to the listeners again while I accumulate my own for a big Mazel Tov in a week or two. Super listener Jeffrey Grossman wants to send a Mazel Tov to his son Seth, who just turned 41. Seth is an avid unorthodox listener, and his dad says, a great father to my two grandsons, a wonderful husband, and the proudest part of my life. And listener Alyssa Reiner just passed her licensure exam to be a social worker. She's graduating with her MSW at the end of August, and she says, if you give me a Mazel Tov on the podcast, that would be my favorite graduation gift ever. I haven't received any graduation gifts yet, so the bar is pretty low. She also
about to say, you got a master's in social work, like condolences and thank you for your work. But
I also want to give a shout out to our listener Hayden Cohen, who is writing a book that may or may not, he says, be based on Camp Ramah. It's called Camp Shmama or something.
That name is amazing.
He's almost done with
his
manuscript.
Name.
We hope to see it in bookstores. Good luck to you crossing the finish line. Hayden, I have a Gentile first name, Cohen.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Hayden Cohen is amazing.
And Shmama is actually Hebrew for wilderness, which is really funny.
And a Mazel Tov from our producer, Alyssa Goldstein, who wants to send a big, big shout out to Mirav Fine and Adam Braun, who just got married. Mazel Tov. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Please do write to us. I mean it. You know, it's like it's automatic for me to say it at this point. But I want you to know
inbox
is amazing.
We love our inbox.
Validate us.
Our executive producers are Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Telushkin, and our show is edited by Noah Levinson. But not this week. This week it's edited, no joke, by his mom, Debbie Gallant. Our wonder intern is Sophie Aresti. Our music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision is by Rabbi David Fine of Seattle, Washington. Kosher slaughtering is by the Dyke March in Chicago. It's actually by all of them, everyone who was in the march. We record at Argo Studios, which never liked the designated hitter rule. And we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.